Let's get started. Welcome to the second lecture of research methods course. And for the next four lectures, we'll be talking about quantitative research. So let's start with the question, what is quantitative research? What do we mean by quantitative research? And why should you care? So any ideas, what is quantitative research? What does it mean? Well, to me, quantitative means something to do with quantity. So quantity, like a lot or a little. So we are talking about numbers. So we do research with data that is in numerical format as opposed to being, for example, observations in the field, videos, transcripts, images. So we have numbers. And that complicates things a bit because, first of all, we have to know a little bit of how to deal with numbers to be able to do something with the numbers, and also because there are limitations that numbers only can tell us. So if we see a number, we have to have a way to assign meaning to the number as well. The number itself doesn't really tell us that much. So quantitative research is typically done with statistical methods, and then we have designs where we try to get large numbers of observations, large number of numbers that we can apply our statistical methods to. So that's in the nutshell, in comparison to qualitative research, where you try to collect rich data in all possible formats, maybe from a smaller number of cases. So you don't need to generalize statistically as we want to do in quantitative research. One thing that I like to start with is whether quantitative research or statistical research is difficult. So most of you, I've been told, are going to use use qualitative methods in your master's thesis because you perceive it to be easier. And I like to contrast qualitative and quantitative research with writing a book and doing a painting. So it's obviously going to be very difficult to write a best-selling book. And it's very difficult to do a painting that will sell for millions. So we have one of the biggest books that's published recently, and also we have a Picasso painting here. So none of you can do any of these. The problem is that if you give a child a pencil, anyone can draw something. So you think you can paint if you can do something with the pencil. But if you give a pencil to a child and ask them to write something, they can't. So you have to learn how to write before you can write the book. But just knowing how to write doesn't make you a good quantitative researcher. Similarly, just knowing how to do something with a pencil on a paper doesn't make you a good artist for doing paintings. So both of these are difficult, but doing something with qualitative research is easier than doing something in quantitative research. So there is kind of like this small threshold that you have to pass in your skill to even be able to do something. And in these four lectures, I will try to teach you how to write. So what are the basics of doing quantitative research. Then if you want to become a professional, there's of course lots more things to learn. Same thing in qualitative. You can do something after this course, but to be a master, you will of course have to do a lot more. We'll have four lectures. And during this first lecture, we'll talk about research design and inference. Inference is päättely in Finnish. So we try to we have some data. We try to make some kind of inference based on that data. So then we try to come up with explanations for the data. We test hypotheses based on the data, and so on. Then in the second lecture, we'll talk about measurement, and that deals with surveys and like how do you measure user satisfaction on an information system. So how do you come up with the numbers? That's the issue about measurement. Quantifying something that is not a numerical quantity to start with, like satisfaction, it's not a number. You have to assign a number to something, and that is the definition of measurement. That's one of the big problems in quantitative research. Then on the third lecture, we'll be looking at actual analysis tools. Mostly focusing on regression analysis. How many of you have ever heard about regression analysis? So you have the course about probability and basic statistics, right, that you have to take. Am I correct? Has any one of you taken a course in probability? A few, okay. So yeah, we're going to do really, very basic stuff. The regression analysis is the workhorse in quantitative research, and most more advanced techniques are just variations and extensions of a regression analysis. If you know regression well, you should be able to read research done with many other methods as well. Then finally, on the fourth lecture, we'll be looking at more hands-on. How do we actually do a project using quantitative tools? So how do we collect data? How do we formulate the hypothesis? How do we test the hypothesis using the data? And how do we use a statistical software? Which software should we use? That kind of questions. I have the following reading materials for you. So we'll have a book by Singleton and Straits, and you have to read four chapters. So you have to read a chapter about the research design that I hope that you read for this lecture. You have to read a chapter about measurement that I hope you will read for next Monday. And then you have two chapters about analysis that I hope you read for the third lecture. Of course, you have to read this all by the exam, so it makes sense to do it right away because you can ask questions about the material in the class. And also the things that I talk in the class are from the books. So you kind of like learn better when you read and listen at the same time. Then we have one empirical paper by Venkatesh that came out this year in Information System Research. You don't have to read it, but it's a good idea to skim it because we're going to be using that as an example. One of the goals of these lectures is that you have some idea of how to read papers written with quantitative methods. So most information system research, or more than half, is written with quantitative methods, and you have to be able to know something to actually make sense of whether those papers are trustworthy or not. Of course, you can always trust the author's conclusions and the author's introduction, where they explain how great this research is and how important the findings are. But it's very informative to be able to actually look at the findings themselves. If you know some basics of statistical analysis, then you will be less likely to be fooled by misleading statistics. We'll start with statistical inference. So how do we infer stuff from quantitative data? And I like to start with an example from a book by Ketokivu, which is one of the best quantitative research books that have been written in Finnish. So he's focusing on why do we do something and why do we need quantitative research, not so much on the actual method. So he's focusing on the practice of doing research rather than on the tools like most other people do. And his example comes from Talouselämä 500 list. So this is a list maintained by Talouselämä magazine that lists the largest 500 companies in Finland. And in 2005, in the summer, when it's a slow news cycle, there was this big headline on Helsingin Sanomat that the women-led companies were 4.7 percentage points more profitable than men-led companies. So that's what they found. So what do you make of that? We have some data from 500 companies, and women-led companies are 4.7 percentage points more profitable than men-led companies. So what do you make from that data? What does it tell us? So this is a fact. What does the fact tell us? Yeah. So that's what most people see. They see that, well, it must be the women CEOs that caused these companies to be more profitable. But that's not what the numbers tell us. The numbers would support that idea, but they don't really tell us that. So we have to know what is behind these numbers. And to understand whether it actually means that women are better leaders. People, when we see a correlation, for some reason, people want to attribute it a causal meaning, like you did. And And Helsingin Sanoma did as well. So there's a big headline that that women make companies more profitable. Naiset tekevät tulosta. That's what it was in Finnish. And the problem is that this is one point of time. This is one sample. And women-led companies were more profitable. The question is, does this fact generalize? Does it generalize to years, or was this just an exceptional year? Maybe the women-led companies are less profitable on every other year except this one. And also, is it just these 500 companies, largest companies, or is it any company? So you were claiming that women are more better leaders, and that would be generalizing to all companies. So we have to understand the limitations of our data. What can we say based on the data? And to do that, so we have a sample of 500 companies at one point of time. We obviously don't just, that fact is not very informative for us. We want to generalize things. So scientific research is about generalization. So we want to make general statements about the world that apply to as many cases as possible. So how do we generalize from that sample? This brings us to the question, what is the population? So we have in quantitative research, we have the concept of population and the concept of a sample. The population is the larger group of units to which we want to generalize our result from the sample. Why don't we just take the full population then? Why do we use a sample? If we want to generalize to all Finnish companies, why don't we just take the profitability figures and take the CEO gender from all Finnish companies, measure the full population? What would be the problem? The problem is that usually, if you want to measure a million companies, it's going to be very costly to do so. And if we take a sample of, let's say, 500 or 1,000, then typically that is enough. So the result will not change much even if we considered 1,000 more companies. So once you reach those a certain level, certain number of observations, then more is not that useful anymore. Like political polls, they always say that we have a panel of 500 or a few thousand respondents. And that, based on that, you can say something about the whole Finland. So it's about the economics. Also, there's the time dimension. If we want to make a claim that women are better leaders, we would have to measure all possible times from here to future, which obviously is not possible. So what would be the population in the previous slide? We have 500 largest companies in 1 year. Where would we generalize that observation? You're absolutely correct. The number is not five, but it's not far from that. And we'll get to that point. If we see this kind of finding, I would intuitively generalize this to all 500 large Finnish companies over time. So at least that is the population. So large companies and over time. Generalizing this to small companies, one person barbershops, whatever, probably doesn't make much sense. So we probably want to generalize to large companies, so that would be our population. Large Finnish companies, generalizable over time. Then the question is that, as you said, could it be possible that this kind of difference was just by chance only? So is it possible that it just happens that the women-led companies were more profitable in 1 year. And it was just a random instance. It won't occur in any other year. Or it occurs maybe once in 20 years. So how do we? What do we need to know to rule out that this would be just a random chance event? So if we take the profitability of the women-led companies in 2005, and we take the women-led companies' profitability in 2006, those numbers will not be the same, right? Because there will be random fluctuations in profitability over a year. Some companies do better some years, some companies do worse some years. And also companies change their CEOs. So it may be that we have 5 women CEOs 1 year, 7 the next year. So the number of women-led companies and what business companies are will change over time. So we have to rule out chance as an explanation. And the first thing we have to ask, is the difference large? So is 4.7 percentage points difference large? So average, normally return on assets in this sample, the average is about 10%. So if the average return on assets is 10%, is a 5 percentage points difference large or not? How many of you think it's a small difference? Raise your hand. How many of you think it's a large difference? Raise your hand. And rest are sleeping, okay. So the majority of you who responded, or everybody who responded, thinks it's a large difference. Yeah, it is a large difference. So small differences, small random fluctuations happen over time. And large differences happen less frequently, but they do happen. The next thing we have to know is what you pointed out is how many women there were. It was not 5, but it was just 22. So why would it the number of women matter? So if we have a small number of companies, then random fluctuations in the profitability of one company has more impact in the total mean, right? So if we have a small sample, then we are going to be more likely to observe more extreme observations or more extreme values. The purpose of statistical inference is to assess whether this kind of observations can be attributed to chance only. If it's plausible that this finding was pure random incidence, then we probably shouldn't be attributing any causal meaning to it. So that is the first thing you have to check. When you see a number, can it be by chance only? There are many ways of doing this, and I'm going to present you one strategy that is very common. So let's take all these 500 companies. You can actually get them from the Finnish Trade Register, and I did. So I got 500 largest companies in Finland, and I chose 22 companies at random, calculated the mean profitability, took the remaining 488, calculated the mean profitability, and then I got what is the difference in profitability. So I did it. So the difference was 2.43. I did it again, and this time I got a negative minus 1 difference. Third time, almost no difference. So we can see that based on a just random chance, when we take 22 companies randomly, compare against the rest, sometimes we get a small difference, sometimes we get a large difference. And we can go on. So we got minus 4.2, and that is pretty close to the 4.7. So we needed 5 attempts to get too close to the 4.7. And what's interesting, that is to the different direction. So would it make news for women-led companies to be minus 4.7% less profitable?
CEO who makes the record profit.
You are absolutely correct about it. We'll get to that as well. Now we're not asking yet why there is a difference. We're asking whether the difference could be by chance only. So if the difference could be a random thing, then we shouldn't be interpreting it too much. I'm going to tell you a bit about this example later, but let's just work through it first. So we can see that when we take random samples of companies compared with the rest, we get all kinds of different numbers. So we can do it many times. So I did it 20 times, and we got the difference between -4 to about between -5 and +5, and most are around zero difference. So when we take a random sample of companies and compare against another random sample, then there shouldn't be any difference on average, because there's no reason for there to be difference. We can do this many, many times. So I did it 10,000 times, and then we get this kind of distribution of the estimate. So this is called sampling distribution. And the higher the curve, it means that the more frequent the values close to that number are. So most of the time, we got zero difference or close to zero difference. Sometimes we got -10%, sometimes +10% difference. And the question that we ask ourselves is how probable it would be to get 4.7 percentage point difference or larger by chance only. The answer is that out of these 10,000 replications, the probability was 0.035. So 3.5% of time we got 4.7 percentage points positive difference or larger. What does it tell us? Is it probable that we get a 4.7 percentage points difference by chance only? Yeah, it happens sometimes. It's not very common. Less than once in 20 times. And this p here is called a p-value. So that is, if you read academic research, you see these p-values all over. And the p-value tells us what is the probability of observing this kind of effect that we just got if the null hypothesis of no effect holds in the data, in the population. So the idea is that there is no population, in no difference, really, and in a sample we observe a difference. So how probable that would be? If the probability is low, if it would be 1 in 1,000,000 chance to get a difference of 4.7 from this population, then we would say that probably that difference is not due to chance only. With 5%, normally we have a cutoff of 5%, and if the probability is less than 5%, we say that there is a statistically significant difference or statistically significant effect. So here we have statistical significance because 0.035 is smaller than 0.05. So based on the conventional cutoff, this would be a statistically significant result. So it is not a strong result, but there is maybe something to the number. The p-values appear very commonly in published research articles. And if you do your master thesis with quantitative methods, you will also be using and writing p-values. The p-values appear in two formats. One, we have these tables of statistics. So you don't have to know what these statistics are. These are from the Venkatesh paper. And we have these stars. So the stars correspond to certain cutoffs. And the cutoffs are here. So 3 stars mean that the p-value for this statistic is less than 1 in 1,000. So there's less than 1 in 1,000 chance that if there's no effect, we would observe this kind of effect. And a small p-value is evidence for there being an effect in the population. Another example is these appear in writing. So you write something, you make a claim. Individuals who perceive transparency to be high, completeness was positively related to intention. You don't have to understand the context. Then we present a statistic, beta here, that tells the strength of association, and then we have a p-value for that beta. So that is how p-values are used in research. We'll be looking at that more in the lecture about regression analysis. The p-value thing is very commonly misinterpreted, even by researchers and even by people who teach statistics classes. So let's do an example of null hypothesis significance testing. Let's calculate a p-value based on data that we will collect now. So on the next slide, I will have two dice from 1 to 6. And your task is to guess what those dice are. And the idea is we're going to be testing if you can foresee what is on the next slide. Guessing this correctly is 1 out of 36. So guessing it correctly would be improbable. So if you guess it correctly, therefore, you may be clairvoyant. So write down numbers, two numbers between 1 and 6. Or you can just think about two numbers. I'm just going to count on your honesty. 2 and 5. So how many of you foresee that it was 2 and 5? 1 person, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, congratulations. You can see the future with p is less than 0.05. You are statistically significantly a clairvoyant person at 0.05 criteria. Do you think you're clairvoyant? Do you think you foresaw it, or you were just guessing? Yeah, so this is not a very strong test. It just gives us a baseline of ruling out chances and explanations. The idea was that if you the null hypothesis here is that you chose your response randomly. So that's the baseline that we compare against. And then the p-value for answering correctly, if you guessed randomly, is 1 out of 36. And then if you answered correctly, you're clairvoyant that p is less than 0.05. So that is the p-value. And okay, so let's say you got a small p-value for yourself. Then the question is, are we making an error in inference? We can make two kinds of errors when we do statistical inference. First, in this test, we could, the colors are pretty bad, so unfortunately, the projector doesn't reproduce the cells here. The idea is that we have two types of statistical error. Type one means that we are saying that you're clairvoyant, even if you're not. And that is what the p-value reflects. That's our acceptable level of type one error rate. Type two is false negative. We may have some clairvoyant people here who just lied about the dice because they don't want to be discovered or something. So it's possible that we don't detect an effect. Which one is more serious? That we falsely say that there is an effect, or that we falsely say that there is no difference, no clairvoyance? Which one is more serious? What do you think? Well, if I analyze the data of the companies and I found there's no difference between men and women, no one is gonna care. So no one is gonna care about findings of no difference. And only findings where there is a difference, there's a relationship, where there are clairvoyance in the people, are gonna be published and people care about. So that kind of error is much more severe normally than not detecting an effect. Because not detecting an effect just tells that, well, maybe someone else will detect it in a future study. If I detect an effect, then many people take it as an absolute truth based on just one study. So type one error is something that we are more concerned about. Then we have also another strategy besides p-values. It's less commonly used in academic research, but it's more commonly used in, for example, political polling. And that is called confidence intervals. Confidence interval basically tells us the same thing as a p-value. And oftentimes, so we say that the return on assets difference is 4.72 percentage points, with confidence interval between 5, with 1 and 9, for example. So then people say, well, 0 is not in the interval, then there must be a difference. If 0 is in the interval, then we can conclude that there's a difference. Same in political polling. When you see that that Keskusta has 22% popularity, Kokoomus has 19% popularity, and the margin of error is plus minus 2 percentage points, then you say, well, it can be by chance only. It falls within the margin of error. So that's the confidence intervals. Both of these are commonly misinterpreted. So null hypothesis saying that the p-value is low does not mean that we are confident in the result. So even though you got a p-value of less than 0.05 doesn't tell us that you're 95% certain to be a clairvoyant person. And same thing with the confidence intervals. They are usually misinterpreted. What you have to understand about these is that a small p-value, stronger evidence, and narrow confidence interval means stronger evidence. So we have to quantify the uncertainty due to our small sample variations in the data. Okay, let's move on. Let's say that we have one way or another established that there really is a difference between men and women-led companies. So the next question, that is the interesting question, is whether naming a woman as a CEO causes the firm to be more profitable. So when you see a statistic, the first thing you don't ask yourself is whether it can be by chance only. The first thing you normally do is you try to attribute causality to the observation. Because if there's just random fluctuations, then Helsingin Sanomat wouldn't publish it, right? The thing is that people attribute causality. Even this is from a McKinsey report. They are comparing companies, women-led companies, men-led companies. They have the same result. Women-led companies are more profitable. And then they say that there is a statistically significant difference, but you cannot attribute causality. But then they go on and argue that we would like to attribute causality nevertheless. And then people who read this kind of report make bold claims like Fast Company did, that in order to improve companies' financial performance, provide a way forward for women to advance to senior positions. To do that kind of claims, that kind of arguments properly, we have to go beyond just statistical inference. We have to do a causal inference. And that is the next topic. So how do we attribute causality to a correlation? Or can we even do that? We have to, doing a correlation and doing a significance test is very easy. You just load your data to SPSS or whatever, Excel, and you calculate the correlation and its p-value. That'll tell you whether there is a significant correlation. Whether it's a causal effect that the correlation reflects is an entirely different matter. And it's much more complicated than just saying that something is not due to chance only. The first thing about causal inference is to ask whether we actually need it. So would it be just informative? Would the observation in and itself have any value? So we have the first task of statistical analysis is description. We're describing one sample that is where women-led companies are more profitable than men-led companies. Does that kind of observation have any value in and itself? Well, maybe that observation suggests that there is something worth studying there. So maybe that descriptive observation is valuable in that sense. If we have a descriptive observation that 70% of students fail the first time they take the exam from this class, which is not far from reality, that is a useful statistic for us because for you students, it tells that you should probably study a bit more. And for us as teachers, it tells us that, well, maybe we should do something about it. So sometimes description is useful. Then we have the next thing that we move beyond description is prediction. So we can do predictions based on statistics. So we have not established any causal link yet, but we have identified that when there's a change of CEO and a woman takes over, the company will become more profitable the next year. Would that kind of observation be useful? And why? Would that be useful in any way? Yeah, it would be useful. At least when I get a little bit more money on my bank account, I would like to invest it. And if I can predict which companies will be more profitable in the future, that it will help me do investment decisions. So prediction is it's another step forward from just pure description. But it doesn't really, if something predicts other thing, like sun setting in the evening predicts that the sun will rise in the morning, it doesn't cause the sun to rise, it just predicts. So we can have these regularities in the data. So those are useful, but it's still, in academic research and research generally, we want to go beyond just being able to predict, even though that is useful as well. So we want to explain why there's a difference between the companies. And in explanation, we have two different types of, or two different variants of things. We have causal inference, where we attribute causality. We're saying that women cause companies to be more profitable, but we don't really know why. We just know that there's a causal relationship, we don't know why. Would that kind of relationship be useful? We know that something causes another thing, we don't know why. There are lots of medicine that we know that cure diseases that are very serious, but we don't know why. We just happen to have observed that giving medicine A to a person with disease B will cause the disease B to go away with a certain probability. We don't know why. It is very useful to be able to infer causality even though we don't know why. And the fourth thing is that we have a causal explanation, in which case we can attribute causality and we can also tell why there's a causal relationship. For example, we can say that women have better social skills, therefore they're better leaders, and the companies that they lead will be better. Let's get back to the example. So naming a woman as a CEO causes profitability to increase. To make that kind of claim, we would have to think about why there's a difference. So how about some alternative explanations? You said something about companies being profitable, then they could have more diverse boards and so forth. And what kind of other explanations we could have? Why is there a difference? Let's assume that the gender of the CEO has no, of the leader of the company has no influence on profitability. Let's assume that to be true. Why would we observe still that there is a difference? Yeah, so you were saying, just to paraphrase, that profitable companies choose their CEOs differently from less profitable companies. So it may be that more profitable companies are more likely to choose women as their CEOs. So we may have reverse causality. So what other explanations could we have? Maybe certain industries are more profitable than others, and certain industries are more likely to have women CEOs. Like ore processing, it's not very high margin industry. And they have lots of assets and mostly male CEOs. The CEO gender and profitability are not linked, but it's the ore processing industry that causes the male CEO and the profitability. So we can have these third variables. Also, it may not be the women itself, it may be that more diversity is better, and because most companies are led by teams of men, then adding one woman increases diversity. So we can have all kinds of explanations, and those explanations of why are theory. So we need to have a theory of why there is a difference, and also we need to have alternative theories for the difference that we need to rule out. And as Arto explained, he used a slightly different explanation or description of theory, but theory is an explanation for a phenomenon. It essentially answers why something happens, and the why part is very important. So we need a theory, and we need to answer the question, why are the return on assets between these two groups of companies different? And we have a multitude of alternative explanations that we went through already. So here are a few. Let's say that women CEOs create better teams create more profitable companies, or smaller firms are more profitable, smaller firms are more likely to hire women. So we have a third variable that causes these two other variables to correlate, which makes the correlation spurious. There's no causal relationship. Industry the same, we can have a reverse effect. Profitable companies can afford to hire women, and then we may have just that there's something in women that makes them better leaders, which would be the fifth alternative hypothesis. And when we make statistical analysis, we don't really know what is behind the numbers. Only thing we can get is more numbers, so we can have more things. So just looking at gender CEO and CEO gender and profitability is not enough. We would have to take firm size and industry into consideration as well. And so we need to rule out these alternate explanations. And to do that, we need more data. To make a causal claim is one of the central goals in quantitative research. So we really, really want to attribute causality to correlations. So how do we do that properly is an important question. And there are three conditions for causality that we must demonstrate to be able to validly argue that there's a causal relationship between two things. One thing is that they have to be associated. So if there are two variables, they have to be correlated. If there are two groups, there must be a difference. So there must be some kind of statistical association between the cause and the effect, so the X and the Y. Then we have to show that it's actually the X that precedes Y, not the other way around. Then we have to eliminate rival explanations. So we have to come up with alternative theories that we try to rule out with our data. So do alternative theories, test those, and just show that our theory that it's actually the women who cause profitability explains the data better than any alternative theory. How do we do the second one? The first one is just the correlation. You can do that with Excel and check the significance. How do we rule out the second, reverse causality? There is a very simple strategy for ruling out the reverse causality. Let's take the CEO gender in 2004 and profitability in 2005. Then we know that it's very unlikely that profitability in the future has caused the CEO gender in the past. Things don't work that way. So we measure the cause before the effect. That is very simple strategy. So you introduce this time dimension into your analysis. Then for elimination of rival explanation, that is more challenging to do. So that is what most papers and studies using quantitative analysis, if they're well done, focus on. We have two empirical strategies. One is that we can do an experiment, and another is that we can do a statistically model the alternative explanations to demonstrate that our explanation is the best. So how does experiment work? And why do experiments allow us to rule out alternative explanations? In an experiment, we take a group of some population that we, or some sample that we split into two groups randomly. So we randomly assign people to control group and treatment group. Then the treatment group receives the treatment. For example, we run two classes that we divide people into randomly. In one class, we have a new teaching method. In another class, we have old teaching methods. Then at the end of the course, we compare which group of students did better. If there's a difference, then the only plausible explanation for that difference is that the one group received the new teaching method, whereas the other group received the old teaching method. Same thing we can do with information systems. We experiment randomly. Half of the people in the company use old information system, half use a new system. And then we ask about user satisfaction 1 month on. And if there's a difference, then the only reason for there to be a difference is because the one group observed, used the new system and the other group used the old system. So we measure difference, and then the only reason for there to be a difference is because of the treatment. How so? Why? Why would that be the case? The reason why this holds is that because of randomization, these two groups are on average equal. So there is no difference between the groups to start with, and the only difference between the groups is that one got the treatment, other didn't. This is a very good strategy for testing things. Medical research, new medicine, they have to go through this kind of procedure. Their procedures are a bit more, let's say, evolved from this very basic design, but the principle is the same. We want to show that the difference in the end is because one group got the treatment and not because we chose the groups in a particular way. If we test a new teaching method, and we allow the students to self-select whether they receive the new teaching method or an old teaching method, it could be that more motivated students pick the new teaching method, and for that, because of that, we have a difference in the end. Randomization rules out that alternative explanation. Then we repeat this many times in different organizations, and finally, we know that there is really an effect. So would this be a plausible strategy for testing the effects of women CEOs? Could we do an experiment? Buy all the companies, assign, take 250 random Finnish men, 250 random Finnish women, assign those to CEOs, and see what happens in 2 years. We would need a lot of money to do that, and we would probably lose a lot of money because the companies would probably do really badly because of random assignment of CEOs. So experiments are not feasible in all contexts. They are good when we're studying individuals. For example, if we're studying individuals' use of information systems, then we can do experiments. If we are studying the effects of an information system on organizations' financial performance, it's going to be very tricky because we would have to have lots of organizations, and if the organizations believe that there's a difference that the information system makes, then they would not opt in if there was a chance that they will do less well. So we often have to use the second strategy called statistical controls. In statistical controls, the idea is that we have first some kind of difference. So let's say that there's some association between gender and performance. Again, I'm sorry, the color doesn't show. And there's some kind of difference. Then we think about alternative explanations that we model with control variables. So let's control for the size. And the idea of using a control variable for size is that we are, instead of looking at how much gender and performance overlap, We are looking at what is the unique overlap between gender and performance after we eliminate the effect of size from the R equation. So we try to make the companies somehow more comparable. Let's assume that large companies, there are no companies with more than 250 people that are led by women. So one way to make the control for the size would be just to focus on small companies, just eliminate all companies with 250 or more people from the data. Hypothetically, we could get that kind of result, a smaller difference. So male-led companies become more profitable, and women-led companies only slightly less, slightly more profitable. So the when we make the two samples more comparable by doing, this is called matching, by doing matching, then we can rule out that there is a third variable affecting the result. Of course, this gets pretty cumbersome if you have to rule out five alternative explanations. So instead, what we do is that we do statistical modeling, and we'll talk more about that a bit later. The idea is that we say that the return on assets depends on both gender and company size, and then we let the software figure out which one of those is more strongly associated with return on assets after controlling for the other. That is what regression analysis does for us. So when we see a statistic or we design a study, we have to think about what are the possible alternative explanations that we may have for the data. And to do that, we use control variables. And here's an example from a published paper, from the Venkatesh paper. And it's very common that you have this section where they explain, okay, we have a theoretical relationship which should correspond to a certain observation. Here are all our plausible alternative explanations. So we have these alternative theories for the data that we have to test at the same time, because we cannot do experiments in many situations. So comparing experiments and statistical controls. Experiment allows us to make really strong claims because we are randomizing people into two groups, and only difference between the groups after the experiment is because one got treatment, other didn't. In statistical controls, we don't have that luxury of randomly allocating people. Rather, we just have to check what kind of statistic we got, and then try to rule out alternative explanations using whatever data we have. Okay, so this far we have assumed that we have alternative theories. So we have alternative explanations for the data. We haven't really looked into where do the explanations come from. And the question is, can we just take a correlation and based on that correlation try to argue that there's a causal relationship? No, we can't. Just by observing a difference between men and women-led companies doesn't allow us to make the conclusion that women cause profitability. The reason is that there are lots of random differences, random correlations. I like this one website. There's a guy who collects, he data mines lots of databases in the US, and he finds correlations. So he found, for example, that suicides by hanging and strangulation and suffocation is almost perfectly correlated to a science spending of science, space, and technology. So if we see this kind of almost perfect correlation, and should we start theorizing that maybe we should hang more people to get more money for space exploration? Or should we do the other way? So which way is the causality? The thing is that just because we observe a relationship, it doesn't really mean anything. We have to have a research design behind the observation for us to make any kind of claims about causality. We could probably get a pretty high correlation of, let's say, if we tested gender, color of your shirt, how long your hair are, and if you sit on the left or right side of the hall. So we will get a high correlation eventually when we just try to think about different attributes that you may have. So you will have these by chance only. This relates to how we do inference with quantitative data. And this links back to what Arto said about deductive and inductive reasoning. So the idea in statistical and quantitative research is that we start with a theory. So we have theoretical concepts, and we call the relation between those theoretical concepts a proposition. CEO gender causes profitability. Then we have empirical concept, which is something that we could measure. That would be our hypothesis. For example, our CEO gender is statistically associated with return on assets. And then we go on and we measure if that is actually the case in a particular sample. Then if it's the case, we can infer that maybe the theory is correct. So we don't go from observing a statistical association trying to think what it means. So that would be the inductive strategy. We observe something in the data, and then we try to attribute meaning to that data. We can't do that in quantitative analysis. Rather, we have a theory that we go on then and test. So we need some kind of design for the testing. We don't do the inductive in quantitative studies. Here is an example from a published research from the Venkatesh paper that you'll read for the next class. And they have a theory. So they have a theory of why accuracy of information should explain why people use e-government services. So they have this one paragraph elaborate explanation of why and how accuracy of information matters for people's intentions to use a particular e-government system. Then at the end, they have a hypothesis. If the theory is correct, then we should observe that there's a statistical association between accuracy and intention to use e-government, and that association is positive. This is an example of deductive reasoning in practice. So we start with explanation of how, why, and when, the theory. Then we have a hypothesis that is that we should observe if the theory is correct. So hypotheses are kind of like this small test of our theory. If we don't observe the theory, the hypothesis, if the hypothesis doesn't hold in our data, that would mean that the theory must be incorrect. Or our research is flawed, either way. Next question is, the importance of theory cannot be overemphasized when you try to make causal claims. Unless you do an experiment, in which case you don't have to be that much concerned about theory. But for statistical controls, you must have a theory. So where do theories come from? Where did the theory that women cause companies to be more profitable, where did it come from? Maybe some person has observed that in his or her life, women-led companies have been more profitable, has developed a belief, and then seeing the difference, that difference enforces his or her belief. So that's one way. Another way, we might be just thinking about how things may work, just theorizing. Or another way is by qualitative research. So qualitative research is different from quantitative research in one key factor. In quantitative research, we cannot observe the causal process. So when we say that a woman CEO causes a company to be more profitable, there must be something that the woman does for the company to be more profitable. And to make a causal claim, we could just go on and observe what does the woman do differently? And then we can come up with an explanation of why there is a difference. Unfortunately, with quantitative data, we just have numbers. We cannot look beyond those numbers. In qualitative research, for example, if we videotape the women CEO's office and male CEO's office for a year, we could probably say a lot about why those companies that they lead differ. We can't do that. So in qualitative research, we actually don't do these three things, association, influence, and rival explanation. Rather, you go to the field and you observe what is the causal process like. If you have a really good data that shows the actual process, then you don't actually need any of this. So association, direction of influence, and eliminate the rival explanations. They're just like a workaround for quantitative researchers because we don't really see the causal process through our data, which is unfortunate. Okay, questions and comments this far. We have discussed about the p-value a bit, causal inference a bit. So when can we attribute causality to a difference? We need the difference or association. We need a time dimension, and we need to eliminate rival explanations. Any questions on these topics? We'll look at practical examples in the last class, and if there are no questions now, we can move forward to the second topic of the lecture, which is a bit about research designs and a bit about quality of or what makes research trustworthy. How many of you know the concept of reliability and validity in research? Arto explained them a bit. You know, yeah. Anyone else? Okay, a few. So reliability is whether if we study the same thing again using the same procedures, whether we get the same result. So a very common metaphor to use for teaching this is the target and shooting. So if you have a reliable guy, he is very precise, he always hits the same target, or a girl. He always hits the same spot. So that is being reliable. It doesn't guarantee that you will always hit the bullseye. So validity is whether you're actually hitting the bullseye. So whether your claims in the study are actually true. So validity is more general concept. Reliability would be, we could have a reliable scale that gives always, when we step on it, it always gives us the same result, which is 5 kilos off. Or we could have a valid scale, but it's unreliable. We step on it, it gives us roughly the correct result, but it is randomly off to some direction. And these concepts of reliability and validity are really well defined, and they're really central when you assess the merits of a quantitative or statistical study. There are many different categories or ways to think about this, and I like to use this kind of categorization, which we'll be using through these four lectures. So reliability is basically whether if we get the same data again, would we get would it be similar or not? Because other than that, if we document our procedures in a statistical study well enough, then you can exactly reproduce the analysis. Even another person could exactly reproduce. So the only thing about that is unreliable, ideally, in a statistical analysis is the data. In qualitative research, there is some researcher-related uncertainty as well. Then we have measurement validity. We talk more about that next week. But it's basically whether our data actually measures what we want them to measure. Then we have statistical conclusion validity, which is basically what we talked about, the statistical inference. Did we really observe something that is not due to chance only? And then we have internal validity, which refers to whether the observed associations are actually causal relationship, or whether there is a third factor that causes the relationship. And then finally, external validity is about whether the study generalizes. So if we observe something in Finland, does it generalize to Sweden? If we observe something at this university, does it generalize to Aalto University, for example? So that is the external validity. Then we have quantitative research, and any research ideally follows a process. So you start with something, you go through a sequence of steps, and you end up with something. We always, any research starts with a research question. So you must have some kind of thing that you want the research to do. Just do research open-ended without any aims. It's not a good idea. So you have to have some kind of focus. And you have a topic that may interest you. Arto discussed about those a bit last time. And based on that topic, you answer a research question or you propose a question that you think is answerable with research methods. Then we have research design, we prepare how we actually want to answer the question. Then we collect data. And when we collect data, we have to think about two different things. One is sampling, and another one is measurement. So if you think of your data as an Excel sheet, then sampling is about what are the rows in the sheet, and measurement is about what are the columns in the sheet. So the CEO gender example, which companies do we take into our study, which company we sample, and what do we, which variables we need from those companies. We need at least the gender, and we need our return on assets, maybe something more as well. Then we collect the data. When the data are collected, we need to process the data somehow. It is usually a time-consuming thing. Then we do an analysis and interpret the results. And if everything goes well, we have a master thesis or a paper or a dissertation or maybe something else that you can publish somewhere. So what makes a great quantitative study? So where is the quality of a study determined? The quality of a study actually is determined before you even start to analyze the data. It all comes to, boils down to whether you're asking a question that is worth asking. If your research question is worthless, it's either well known or no one cares, then the study is not going to be very interesting, regardless of how well you answer it. If your data are crap, then there is really no other remedy but to collect more data. Just redo the thing. If your data analysis are bad, it's usually, if you get some advice from somebody, it's usually easy to fix the analysis. So data analysis is something that can be fixed. But if you have a bad design, bad data, or bad question, that is something where you have to go back to the drawing board or just live with the fact that you don't have a very good study. We have four main designs for quantitative research and any research generally. And these designs really center on the issue is on the question of how do you get the data. So we use data to make inferences. And the first is an experiment. So we can have a laboratory. We take people to the laboratory. One group uses one information system, another one uses another information system. Then they answer a questionnaire about their satisfaction. If there's a difference in the scores, then it must be because of the system. So that is the lab experiment. You can do experiments in the field. It's more challenging, but that is the prototypical experiment. Then we have survey. So survey is basically a non-invasive thing. So you go and you ask people's opinions, or you and then people answer to your questionnaire, or people answer to your interview. And based on data that people give you, then you make inferences. This has its own challenges because people may lie to you and your questions may be bad, things like that. Then we have field research, which involves you going to the field and actually observing data. So you go to the field and you observe how people use information systems in the real life. You don't intervene, you just see what happens, collect data, and then you analyze the data. And the fourth thing is archival methods. So maybe there is some kind of data that has been accumulated over the years, a user log from an information system, financial statements from companies to the tax authorities, something like that. And then you go on and use that as your data. So all these four have their different advantages and disadvantages. The field studies are difficult to replicate because it's difficult to get the exact same field setting, for example. Laboratory studies are easy to replicate, but whether something done in a laboratory, particularly if it's done with student samples, generalizes to real world where adults working companies, that's another question. So when you think about the research question, the first thing is what is the best design out of these four, or should I use a combination? And then you start to think, what is the data that I need and how do I instrument the study? Let's take a couple of examples of a quantitative research design. And this is one that I participated myself as a test subject. And this was last year. I went to the Asuntomessut which is a fair where you see apartments and houses and you can go and get ideas if you want to build or buy or renovate something. And there are all kinds of construction companies and things like that that demonstrate what they do. And there was this Sato Studiokoti, which is basically a single room apartment built into a shipping container size space. And it's like 20 square meters. And you walk through it, past it here, and there was the container. And then on the back side of the container, there was a balcony. And on the balcony, there was this kind of small polling station that we have by the cafeteria, which asked whether the studio code, the small apartment, is a good idea or not. You could agree or disagree. My first question is this a descriptive study, a predictive study, or a causal inferential study? What does Sato want to know? Well, they only get one number because they're going to get one variable, whether I press 1, 2, 3, or 4. And then they get an average of all those presses of all people. So it's a purely descriptive study. It is clearly useful for Sato because if everyone thinks it's a bad idea to build this kind of things, then they should not build them. If everyone thinks it's a great idea, then they know that, well, we should build these things, really. So this is a prototype. So what kind of problems do you see in this research design? You're asking people whether something is a good idea or not. This is a fundamentally flawed design for one reason. That is a small flaw in the study, but there is another really fundamental flaw. The polling station, to get there, you have to go through the small apartment. People who couldn't care less about the small apartment will never see the polling station. So you have a large selection effect. And that is something that even, like, these are guys are probably who did that are marketing research professionals. So even professionals don't really necessarily think through their design decisions. They will probably get 3s and 4s because people who dislike the idea will never go in there. A better way would be to have one on the front and another one on the back. Then you can compare. Okay, how about this one? We have a self-checkout. So the idea is that you go and you scan your groceries yourself, and then you pay with credit cards. And the research question is, which factors affect whether people use this kind of system? How would you study it? So you can form groups of 3 to 4 people, just talk with the people next to you and come up with different ways of studying what influences persons' decision to use this new technology. This is a very typical new technology adoption study, which is a prototypical information systems research study. So, just form most group and think about different ways. How do you study? Okay, so let's take a step back. Before we ask the question, how should we study, we should think about alternative theories that explain people's use of these systems. So why do you think that people will choose self-checkout over visiting a cashier who is a person? It's faster. That's one. People perceive it to be faster. Okay. It can be slower. People perceive it to be faster. Any other ideas? Is there any particular reason why one would like to use self-checkout? Yeah, well, you don't have to speak to a cashier, but for some people, they may be, they may not want to. For example, if you're drunk, you don't want to see the cashier you're being drunk. Any other reasons? Both are actually justifiable. Yeah, that's true. You buy adult entertainment, for example. Any others? I didn't think of that before, so I would give you extra credit if I could. Any others? Why would people want to use self-checkout? Faster, not have to talk to a person, and buying embarrassing products. I could think of those two reasons, faster and not having to interact with somebody. Why would a person not like to use this kind of system? Yeah, you have so many products that you can't fit them on the tray that you have here. So you have a small tray. Yeah. Any other reasons? Yeah. Any others? They want to talk to somebody. So we have one thing that drives both not using and drives the alternative. Any others? Yeah, so it is impossible for you to use the system because you don't have a card. And you can only use cash to pay cashier. Do you think that the person's age influences person's decision? There is a correlation, definitely, but is it the age per se, or is it the person's intentions to, person's proclivity to adopt new technologies that affects?
I think the intention to adopt technology would be more valid.
Yeah, so intentions to adopt correlates with age, and therefore, age correlates with use. Yeah, I've studied this, actually, and age correlates strongly with use. So age would be kind of like a spurious correlation because it's not causal. Any other? So how do we study it then? Our sample are the people who go through, or do we study something else? Any ideas? How do we study? Do we go to the store, or do we get data from the company about the purchases made through these systems, or do we email people questionnaire, or do we set a laboratory experiment? So we can do all these designs. Which design do you think is the best? So what should you, if you had to study it, let's assume this was your master thesis topic, so how would you go about studying it? So you would go to the store and you would give questionnaires to people who use the self-checkout.
Yes.
How about the people who didn't use the self-checkout?
Well, maybe not
asking Well, we're basically interested in the question of whether the people who are using the system are statistically different from the people who are not. So you have to measure both. Go to the store and then record who goes through, and then you do polling. Do you do the polling before they go to the checkout, when they're in the queue, or do you do it after they go through? Why? But haven't they made it already when they go to the queue? Yeah, so the queue is normally right there, and then you don't switch to another queue. So there are all kinds of, like, if you do simple polling of people, there are all kinds of decisions that have to make. In this scenario, polling them before the checkout, it's a lot better option than polling them after, because for practical reason, when they're standing on a queue, they have nothing to do. They have time to fill your survey. After that checkout, they are in a hurry to go home. They're careless in responding. Another thing is that we want to know which are the factors that influence people's decision, and how people respond to our poll may be influenced by their current experience, by their experience a second ago when they used the system. So there are these decisions. Any other? Could we do it without polling the people? Yeah, so you could use secondary data research or archival data, because that data is collected anyway. I'm not sure if they're legally allowed to collect which cashier you go through, but let's assume they are. So you could have the what kind of things they buy and how much they buy at the one time, what time they visit. So maybe these are more used at the certain times. When the store is not busy, maybe people prefer to go to cashier. Could we set up some kind of experiment? Let's assume that the time is the most... We have a hypothesis that the time aspect is the most important thing. This saves people time. That is why people use it. So could we make an experiment out of it? We could. We could, for example, set up a sign that says that the self-checkout cashier will be 10 minutes faster or 5 minutes faster. Use that one day and not use that other day. Choose the days randomly, and then we can influence people's perceptions on how fast it is. If there's a difference between those 2 days and those two, the days where you have the sign up or where you don't, and you have a large number of days chosen randomly, the only reason why there should be a difference is because of the sign. So we could do experiments. The best, yeah. Yeah, that is true. So you can, even if you try to design an experiment like that, there may be something that the observations are not independent. That would be we would have to take that into account in our statistical analysis eventually. We could model it. But so there are all kinds of things, all kinds of ways that you can study. I studied this, or I helped these guys at the Aalto study this issue. And I came to the paper after they had decided that the research designer had collected the data. And what they did was to get the membership cards, and they got the emails of the people, and then they sent an email to people asking, do you like using self-checkout? And then, do you think that self-checkout is faster? And then whether there's that correlation was basically used to infer that the speed is one of the important factors. It's, of course, a lot weaker design than just going to the field, but we got the conference paper out of it. Okay, I have another example. We don't have time to go through that. Let's talk about next lecture. So next lecture we'll talk about measurements. So how do we quantify things like people's satisfaction with information system, people's satisfaction with our self-checkout, that we really that don't have numerical values that we could take right away. I want you to read the part about measurement from Singleton and Straits for the next class. You will have to read it anyway for the exam, so better do it now. And then skim through the Venkatesh paper. We'll be using that as an example. And the key points from this lecture, the key points to remember are that we have samples of data that we like to use to make some kind of inferences about the population. And the sample itself is normally very important. So if we find a difference in a sample, if it doesn't generalize the population, then the finding is not very important. Then we have three conditions for causality: association, direction of influence, and elimination of rival explanations. And association must not be because of chance only. That is what we quantify with the p-value or confidence interval. We say that the association must be statistically significantly different from zero. Then we have alternative causes that we have to rule out, alternative theories for the data. We have two strategies to eliminate rival theories, rival hypotheses. One is experiments with randomization. Another one is statistical controls. We'll be looking at statistical controls more closely on the third lecture. Then the quality of the study is going to be evaluated based on reliability, measurement validity, statistical conclusion validity, internal validity, external validity. We'll be using this typology through all four lectures. And I'm going to end with this comic. If you have any questions, you can ask those now, and if not, then we'll see you on next Monday. I will do that. Yes.